Broadcasting from the Hip Hop Weekly Studios, I'd like to welcome you to another episode of Civic Cypher, where our mission is to foster allyship, empathy, and understanding. I am your host, Ramses Ja.
He is Ramses Ja. I am Q Ward, and you are tuned in to Civic Cypher.
Indeed you are. Please stick around, because we have another one of these types of shows that are, you know, we're going to have to come to terms with some stuff. On today's episode, the first thing we're going to spend some time talking about is the new wave of tough on crime laws that are aiming to intimidate criminals. And we're going to provide a critical examination of how that tough on crime rhetoric and that approach doesn't really help anyone. It is basically fear-mongering, and you know, it sounds like it would be effective, but it in practice it just isn't.
Yeah, they frame it that way. It's intentional dishonesty.
Yeah,
they know that they're not being tough on quote-unquote crime, and crime, the term, being vague enough for them to keep using it in that way.
Right
when it really, it solves nothing. It just gives them an excuse and a public license to harass, fear-monger, and intimidate people who they have already pre-criminalized.
Exactly. That's a great way of describing it. So we're going to give you a more critical breakdown of this phenomenon. And then we're going to spend the second part of the show discussing the migrant workers who fell into the river and lost their lives in Baltimore. We feel like somebody needs to speak up for them, and, you know, who better to do it than us? We're here with the microphones, and we feel that those people, and indeed that community, deserve some representation. So we'll do our best. But before we get there, as always, we're going to start off with some Ebony Excellence. And I think that you should probably take this one, because it's another one that's kind of right up your alley.
Right up my alley. It's funny. Ebony Excellence, sponsored by Actively Black. Visit ActivelyBlack.com. There is greatness in our DNA. This story is from the Philadelphia Inquirer. Tessa Johnson scored 15 points. Camilla Cordoso added 12. An undefeated South Carolina advanced to the Final Four of the women's NCAA tournament with a 70-58 win over Oregon State on Sunday. 70-58 win over Oregon State on Sunday. I'm sorry. South Carolina made it to the national semifinals unbeaten for the second straight season. The Gamecocks lost to Caitlin Clark in Iowa in the Final Four last year. So imagine head coach Dawn Staley being so incredible that with an entirely new team, she is once again undefeated and once again in the Final Four. The Gamecocks, who have made the Final Four for four straight years, will play North Carolina State on Friday night in Cleveland. Two more wins would make South Carolina the 10th school to finish undefeated, and the second to do it since UConn did in 2016. Top seeded South Carolina, 36-0, led by four at half, built a 14-point lead before number three seed Oregon State got within 62-58 with 3 minutes and 55 seconds left in the game. But the Beavers then missed their final seven shots, and the Gamecocks were able to prevail. Coach Staley, an all-time great player in her own right, and now showing that she is one of the best to ever do it in the coaching ranks as well.
You see why I have him read these things? Because he knows all this extra stuff that's not even in the article. I don't know anything. I've never heard of these people, but I'm glad that they are doing so well. And I'm glad, obviously, for any time there's a Black woman who is thriving. So
indeed.
All right. So let's talk about this new wave of tough on crime laws. These laws are aimed to intimidate criminals, and the article that we're going to read suggests that the experts that are kind of monitoring this phenomenon are skeptical with that approach having the intended results. So before we actually get into the USA Today article, I want to explain how police work. Now, we do this all the time, me and UQ, on the show. Police are, they respond to crime. Once the crime has already taken place, they respond. In 99% of instances, the police respond to crime. They don't prevent the the crime from happening in the first place. Go ahead.
You know, a very interesting thing, because I every time you say this out loud, when you're saying it, I'm a member of the audience. I know this to be true, and it still kind of like calibrates me back into reality. Because television, propaganda, movies, books would have
propaganda, yeah,
that the police are out here full time working to prevent crimes from happening. Mm-hmm. Like that's what they do all day.
Yeah,
what your mind thinks.
And so you would think more police
collectively as a group out here making sure that things don't happen. When, in essence, what you just said is.
Yeah,
very true.
Yeah, so watch this
response to crime mechanism, not a crime prevention thing.
So watch this. Okay, so I watched this YouTube channel. It's called Not Just Bikes. Okay, and it's a YouTube channel about city planning. I'm into some weird stuff, so forgive me. But I like the idea of living in a peaceful, livable, walkable city where you can go out and enjoy nature and take your sons on a walk and that sort of thing, right? And I'm not saying that I'm complaining where I do live, but I just kind of like the thinking, right? And in other parts of the world, so in this part of the world, right, where we live, if you're driving your car too fast, the police will clock you, pull you over, and write you a ticket, right? And that's how they quote unquote control crime. But this fits what we're discussing right now too, because they can only respond to the crime that has been committed, right? Now, in other parts of the countries, what they do is they rework the road in such a way to where drivers' habits reflect the intended speed of the road. In other words, they might, they incorporate, it's called traffic calming elements, like a little bit of a wiggle in the road, or, you know, speed bumps, or, you know, tabletop crosswalks, or, you know, these sorts of things that naturally will cause drivers to slow down. And so they're proactive in preventing the speeding, not reactive. And it works. And as a result, there are less pedestrian deaths, and people walk more, and they get out and they enjoy the city, and they're not cooped up in the home, and they can get places. They don't have to have a car, so it doesn't disproportionately punish poor people. On and on, right? So the way of thinking translates over into like bona fide crimes. Okay. So again, we've talked on the show. If you want to take the reins of this one, because I know you've talked about it before.
I don't want to take the reins, but I do want to speak on the things that you just said.
Please, go ahead.
The problem, however, and this is kind of the elephant in the room with these preventative measures, there's a lot of money to be made in crime response and incarceration and the way that they do business now. Mm-hmm. It's not the way that they enforce the law. It's the way that they do business.
Yeah, that's a great way to say it.
Enforcing the law the way that they do, watching crimes happen and then responding to them and then punishing accordingly, is big business.
So what Q's talking about here is the privatization of prisons. There are people that stand to make money from imprisoned individuals, right?
And every other way, from tickets, from citations.
All of that. They just have their necks on society at large, right? And of course, this disproportionately affects Black, Brown, poor, you know, marginalized peoples. So we're paying this as a tax, not just fiscally, but in terms of our freedom and our capacity to move around and so forth. We have the highest incarceration rate on earth in this country because of this way of thinking, right? So what I was going to say is, on this show, we often suggest that if a person wanted to fight crime, if a governmental agency wanted to fight crime, they could invest in programs that address the root cause of crime, which is often poverty or wealth inequality, access to resources. Yeah, things like this, right? There was one study that I read some years ago, so please don't quote me on this, but I believe it to be true. Again, this is not me standing on this one, but
The idea, and don't pick out the semantics that make it wrong.
Thank you. So there is a correlation between crime rates and access to Head Start programs, access to preschool programs. There is a correlation between crime rates, in other words, crime rates drop when communities have after-school programs. There's a disproportionate effect on crime. In other words, crime goes down as job opportunities increase, right? And so what we have been conditioned into thinking through the propaganda and copaganda and on is that, you know, all the people in jail are just bad guys, and not these people come from bad circumstances where they, it's like, look, I got to bust a move. I got to figure something out. This is what was going on. I had no alternative, blah, 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 which accounts for a significant amount of what we consider to be crime. And by investing in these programs, by investing in Head Start programs, if you really wanted to see the crime rates drop, you would invest in Head Start programs, right? Based on the data. And we'll get into the article because the article kind of explains a little bit better than I do. But this was the whole way of thinking behind the defund the police movement, because, you know, people would say this and they would show this data, and then the lawmakers would push back and say, well, where are we going to get the money from? And they'd be like, well, you're spending the money that you're trying to use to quote unquote fight crime in the wrong place. You know what I'm saying? You're responding to crime while doing nothing to address the root cause. So crime doesn't go down. And then you have this runaway effect where you're just hiring more and more police officers while crime goes up.
Or increasing your budget, even if it doesn't always mean more officers, mm-hmm. It does mean more money.
Right. And we've covered on this show, too, several cities that increase their police budget. They hire more police and it does nothing on the crime rate. The crime rate doesn't go down whatsoever. Right. So now I'll get into this article and then we'll break it down a bit further. So from USA Today, a recent wave of new policies and ballot measures make it clear many politicians across the country think crime is out of control and tougher laws will help fix the problem. See, this is why it's so weird that you can elect people who are not that informed. Right. These people can fearmonger and go ahead.
I think you're showing, as usual, a lot of grace here. I don't think that they don't know any better, that they're not informed. They just understand that things the way they are profit them the most. Mm-hmm.
And conversations like this. We're from Arizona and we had a very notably tough on crime sheriff for a long time, Sheriff Joe Arpaio. And his thing was, I'm going to round everyone up, put them in Tent City. That was the name of the jail out here. I don't know if it still exists, but I think they stopped doing it, maybe.
It was only inhumane. You know, it's 125 degrees outside.
People would, die in there and stuff. Anyway, so this guy was famously, quote unquote, tough on crime. And so it's interesting to see the effect of that. I'm going to keep reading here. So from Louisiana to California, efforts to increase criminal penalties and give more power to police have made it on the books, as politicians say they want to make their streets safer. Most Americans, 58%, meanwhile, now think the country is not tough enough on crime, a reversal from just a few years earlier, 41%, according to public opinion polling from Gallup. Efforts to crack down on crime, commonly called tough on crime laws, have been studied for years and have been found to boost the number of people in jail, but there's little evidence that they're effective. They're effective crime deterrent, experts say. That's in part because most people who commit crime aren't thinking about the penalties for their action. Okay.
And the fear mongering, just to be clear, works on both sides of the aisle.
Mm-hmm. Right. Most
affected by this, these policies, still think we need more because we've been taught that indoctrinated. Right. We do need more police so we can be safer.
And here's the thing, for anyone listening to us today, if you think this, if you thought this in the past, I'm not mad at you because it makes sense, right? It makes sense. Yeah, well, more police, tougher laws, right? It just makes sense if you just hear it and listen to it on its face. But we are a data-driven enterprise here at Civic Cypher. We use the stories to give you an aperture into the data to help you interpret and understand the data. But this is all based on data, right? Every episode we do is either based on lived experience or data. There's some data set that affirms the positions that we take.
Yes, indeed.
And this is no exception, right? So again, for people that once thought, okay, well, yeah, that makes sense. I want more police. That I want to live in a safe community. More police. Police make me feel safe. So let's get more police. Why not? Well, you're spending the money and you're not safer. It just doesn't work. And so when you look at the data, logical people would not give in to their emotions, you know, not say, well, the police make me feel safe, so let's just get more police. Logical people say, well, if the police aren't making us safer, we should probably do something that makes us safer.
Yeah, it's about giving people the proper lens to stop and have that conversation mm-hmm. with themselves, though, because mm-hmm. this next paragraph that you're about to read speaks to how they so effectively frame this so that even logical people hear it and don't process it.
So do me a favor. Why don't you take this one? Because you got something for me.
Tough on crime laws attempt to solve crime by stigmatizing people who commit crimes rather than addressing the root causes, driving mass incarceration and disrupting families and communities while heavily impacting people of color, said Sherry Stone. I think that's Mediator,
mm-hmm.
the co-founder of the advocacy group, Perot, Illinois, and a professor at Ohio Wesleyan University. Some policies that have popped up recently may have intended to send a message about crime tolerance rather than stopping crime directly.
Right.
Or crime intolerance, if you will, mm-hmm. right? If you do something, we're going to punish you worse. Mm-hmm. But it was mentioned earlier in the story, when scarcity and poverty and hunger and sometimes health crisis like drug addiction come into play, people are not thinking, man, if I do this, I'm going to get in trouble. People are thinking, I'm starving and you got it and I don't got it.
Yeah.
And I forgive my lack of proper dictation there, but that was intentional.
Mm-hmm.
You have it and I don't have it.
No, you got it. I don't got it.
Like that food, money,
whatever.
Their fix.
Yeah, these are property crimes.
So
it's not like these people are doing fraud, wire fraud. Yeah,
they're not weighing the consequence.
Let me hold on, because there's some people that do wire fraud.
Oh no, please believe it. Yeah. Please believe it. There's some bad actors.
But the crimes that we're thinking of, yeah. like property crimes and
the crimes that they're being tougher on, let's be honest.
Yeah, there you go. That's what I'm trying to
say. They're not being tougher on all crimes.
Yeah.
That's how you see people, quote unquote, getting away with things where they're found guilty and then you see the punishment and you're like, wait, what?
Yeah. They're focused on street crimes, not
they're focused on the type of crimes that you do when you're poor
yeah.
or hungry.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so the way that a lot of people in this country have to survive is categorized as criminal. You know, there's a reason, ironically, that marijuana, legal marijuana, has become a multi-billion dollar industry, but it's still categorized the same way.
Mm-hmm. It's a Schedule I drug.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's in the same category as whatever the worst drug you're thinking of right now. Marijuana still stays in the same category. There's a reason, because they're kind of stuck, right? They're benefiting the most from this new legal industry, but they understand that there are still people that look like you and I who could and do profit from the sale, legally or illegally, of that plant.
Mm-hmm.
And they need to still be able to punish it as aggressively as they always have. Yeah. So they're kind of stuck right now trying to justify that to themselves, how this is still the way that it is. And, you know, a conversation that our president has had to have with some of the people around him regarding
it's been a heavier lift for him than he originally suggested. And we've looked into this recently, you and me both, to see kind of what the status of. Neither one of us have ever tried any drug. Neither one of us have ever drank alcohol in our lives, and we're in our 40s. But this is something we're very interested in because, again, we know that it disproportionately affects Black and brown people, so you're not wrong about that. But yeah, again, these people that approach crime like it's almost like it's cool when they do it, it's a problem when I do it, right?
And even then they figured out a way to to make one form of a substance.
Oh yeah, cracking cocaine, yeah,
and another form of the exact same substance, an entirely different
crime.
Yeah,
I think it's six based times on
who's more likely to commit the crime. So right. It's not in the shadows.
Yeah.
They're playing in our face, as the young people say.
Yeah, this has been now 40 years now. The example Q's talking about is cocaine compared to crack. And the sentences were harsher for crack, and the compassion and the approach from the criminal justice system was certainly a lot more lenient with cocaine than it was with crack, because crack disproportionately affected Black and brown communities, Black communities in particular,
and poor communities. Don't forget to leave that part out. Yeah. I mean, don't forget to include that part. Sure. I'm sorry.
Sure. All right. So tough on crime in this country is a way of thinking about how to deal with social problems that became strongly articulated in the late 70s and 80s. Stone Mediatore said, Since then, study after study has shown that it does not work. All right. A good example of tough on crime approach in the U.S. is the war on drugs that saw a sharp increase in the number of people sent to prison for drug offenses starting in the 70s, Bellin said. Yet that didn't reduce the availability of drugs or the number of people using them, Bellin said. So all it did, and we've talked about this too before on the show, all the war on drugs did was criminalize drugs so that you could put black people in jail.
Turn sick people into criminals.
Yeah. And drugs, on this show, we affirm that drug abuse and drug addiction is a health issue, not a criminal issue.
And that's, I don't even want you to frame it that way. Not on this show, health professionals.
Yeah, yeah.
On this show makes it sound like that's
how it is. No. We got that from somewhere.
Now that the right people have become victims of this health crisis.
Yeah, when it's like opioids.
Figured out how to frame it properly.
Yeah. And that feels very hurtful. You got to imagine, if for those of us listening that aren't black and old enough to have lived in the 80s and seen what crack does to a poor community, and to now see the governmental response, which is a lot more compassionate, a lot less heavy-handed, to see the criminal justice system have a lot more compassionate approach, a lot less heavy-handed. And they treat these, you know, often enough, they're white kids who are addicted to these drugs, and it's a health issue, and it always has been. But when you see the approach, and you remember the approach that they had to black people in our community, you're from Detroit, I'm from Compton, so that's really where the crack hit, right? So I was born into that. The first years of my life was that the environment was very much shaped by that. So when you see now, you know, those of us that kind of have that amount of perspective, it almost seems very hurtful. It's like, man, where was y'all at when this was happening to my people? We had to overcome that. And I'm proud of us for having done that. You know, there's some people, obviously there's not all of us, you know, but, you know, that term being associated with crack babies and, you know, all that, you know, all this sort of stuff that made us feel like they hated us.
Born in the 80s, man.
Yeah. And then now to see something similar happen to, you know, a different group of people who are, you know, they're our brothers and sisters. I'm not angry. I don't want it to sound like I'm angry, but it's like, you, in my lifetime, I've been able to see this and realize, you know, I'm not crazy when the elders told me, hey, the deck stacked against you, you got to play the game right. And I have played the game right. Like I said, never done a drug.
Best we can.
Never done a drug, never drank alcohol. Q can say the same thing. And it's because we listened to that. And that turned out to be true. So, you know, food for thought.